Our next case is case number 71742, Cordero versus State. We have Mr. Erickson and Mr. Ports. Reserve any time?
Yes, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes.
May it please the court. This is a fairly simple case as far as the two issues that are involved. A very lengthy sentence for my client that we are trying to get undone to get him before a trial where we can present a full defense. The first issue is that of the motion to continue that we filed about 2 weeks before the trial was scheduled to begin. As is outlined, we found out on July 12, 2016 from one of the what would be a witness at the trial that my client had been, unbeknownst to him, given the drug Ambien. That witness had been watching late night TV and had seen advertisements from law firms about the adverse effects of that drug. Once she became aware of that, she notified our defense team about that. And we then immediately began trying to track down an expert to look into that issue, as we certainly didn't have the expertise ourselves with that drug. So that was on July 12th. We filed the motion to continue trial on July 21st. And 5 days later, the trial judge denied the motion. And
maybe it's because of his background as a U.S. attorney, where they don't grant it to continue until we're in federal court.
Your Honor, I do some trial work over there, and it is often very difficult to get a trial continued there. So, and from the defense standpoint, there's one critical thing that I want to bring out that was actually quoted. It's in the appellate record at page 111 and 112. This is during the hearing on the motion to continue, and this is also quoted in the state's response brief at page 18. And now I'm quoting the judge. Since I'm thinking for the most part this is going to be general medical literature that's out there rather than anything particularly unique that this doctor is going to know, so I'm not inclined to grant the continuance if the state wants to move forward. The state responds, and judge, we would note that the trial is probably going to take 3 weeks, so there's plenty of time for the expert to review the material and the time before. And then the court says, well, then that's part of why I'm factoring in this. So I don't see any reason not to go forward with the trial next week. I'm trying to present a pharmaceutical defense.
Mr. Erickson, with respect to Dr. Pohl, if you had been given more time, what would Dr. Pohl have testified to or needed more time to review? Because he did, in fact, testify at trial. It was quite extensive by my review and informative. I mean, the jury rejected that. So the question is here, if you had gotten a continuance, or if the continuance had been gotten, what else would Dr. Pohl have testified to that would have assisted Ms. Gentleman?
Well, one of the things that was not presented that we would have loved to, and Dr. Pohl had indicated if we had the prescription, we did not have time, and we made some attempts, but we did not successfully subpoena and obtain the prescription records from the witness who had provided the Ambien to my client. So Dr. Pohl was not able to testify from records as to the amounts of Ambien that had been given to my client and thus give testimony as to that level of the Ambien that could have been presented, as well as him being able to verify, yes, this prescription drug was provided to this witness, and we were able to verify that. Because of the short time frame, and this is under the layer of a very, you know, 47-count case, the state indicated that they were anticipating calling in excess of 30 witnesses that we were trying to prepare for, and then we were told, well, you can prepare your defense, basically, while you're in the middle of this trial with these 30 witnesses. And so trying to answer your question, he would have then been able to testify relative to the amounts of the medication. In addition, Dr. Pohl, he is an expert in addictive medications and drugs, but he would have had time to consult experts relative to this particular pharmaceutical, and I think been able to have given additional details to the jury as to the effects that the drug would have had on my client. So it was when I am confronted with trying to work with an expert, I usually don't know what it is that they need until after they have a chance to look at everything, then we figure out, okay, I need to track this down or that. We had no time to do any of that. This was all done on the fly when we were in the middle of the trial.
Talk to us about the tattoos.
And relative to the introduction of the tattoos, the state presented Matthew Zucker. He's a gang expert from the Clark County Detention Center. They made efforts to try to not present to the jury that these were gang tattoos, but no one in their right mind is not going to think that when this expert gets up there and talks about he knows organizations that have numbers and A-dub and things of that nature that they put on their body, and he also testified that they use graffiti for designation of a membership in an organization, that the jury would not know this is reference to gang-related tattoos. This was a defense of involuntary intoxication. It was in no way a whodunit, whether Sean Cordero was at the locations that the state had alleged. So the introduction of those tattoos added nothing to their prosecution as to...
Well, didn't it help identify, you know, I appreciate you're saying it's not necessarily in dispute that this person on Ambien is doing this. But, you know, there's going to be a question about him then putting his own graffiti on the walls that matches tattoos. So it certainly identifies him as perhaps a willful actor and present there. Right?
Yes, but I don't... Here's my response to that. Tying in that he has these tattoos on his body, I think, is completely unnecessary to them. Being able to present witness that, yes, we did not have 1, 2, 3 lightning bolts on our refrigerator when we left the house, and that it would have come from Sean Cordero. But tying in the unnecessarily suggestive body tattooing that was presented, I think goes beyond the probative value of that information and certainly casts Mr. Cordero in a negative light that he was affiliated with.
If you don't have both ends of that transaction, it's much less impactful, not in a prejudicial way, but in a probative way. So if somebody's walking in, you know, putting Boston Red Sox all over the house, okay, well, we think Sean Cordero did that. Wouldn't the jury be more likely to think that he did if his body was covered in Boston Red Sox tattoos? I mean, you got to connect those two things for them to be probative.
Your Honor, I would agree that would help, but I also would argue that it is, in this situation, completely unnecessary where, one, Mr. Cordero is removed from the residence by the SWAT team. There's no doubt he is there. There's no doubt when they come in, they can testify, yeah, we didn't put those markings on in our garage, that they had come from him. But then to go to the next step, I think, is completely unnecessary to say, oh, yes, this matches to some tattoos that he has on his body.
But this didn't just connect Mr. Cordero to that particular graffiti. There were a number of different incidents that also were connected by, in part by this graffiti, correct? Riding it in the car.
Correct.
At the house. So it's not just he wasn't pulled out of the car. I mean, that's a separate incident as well that was presented. Am I right on that?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I guess I would fall back to that was not disputed from the defense that he was in the car, that he was involved in making those markings in the, I guess it was the overhead part of the vehicle. So, again, from our perspective, the probative value where the defense was not disputing Mr. Cordero's involvement in that activity, that the state then introducing that he had these on his body, these tattoos, I simply think is more prejudicial than probative, and given the entirety of the defense, completely unnecessary for the state to present. And
how far did the state go as far as the gang affiliation? Because tattoos, in this day and age, everybody and their uncle has tattoos. You know, it's very common. You know, I'll go to the athletic club, and you see all the women with tattoos, the men with tattoos, and the tattoos certainly have to do with identification. But how did the DA connect it to gangs? How far did they go?
And you're on comes in at volume 4 of the record at page 820, where they had Mr. Matthew Zucker testify. He was the Clark County Detention Center qualified as a gang expert. His qualification was not presented to the jury as a gang expert, but he testified that he had knowledge of an organization that uses symbols such as AW, the numbers 1, 2, 3, and testified that members of this organization wore tattoos and did graffiti with those symbols to symbolize their membership in that organization.
So let's say we find that that's error. Why is it no more than harmless error in this particular case with the overwhelming evidence?
Your Honor, I think that then goes to our third point of cumulative error, that where we have a insufficient presentation of our expert testimony and the involuntary intoxication defense, coupled with this error of Mr. Cordero being made to look as a bad guy because of his gang affiliation, those two things together, I think, bring us to cumulative error, where he did not receive a fundamentally fair trial, and that those two things coupled together should result in a new trial and him being able to present fully his defense.
You want to reserve about 2.5 minutes?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Mr. Quartz, on behalf of the District Attorney's Office.
Thank you, Justices. Mr. Quartz, on behalf of the District Attorney Office, and may it please the Court.
Mr. Quartz, was identity in dispute in this case?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And with regards to the admission of the tattoos and graffiti, that is a point that I do want to touch on. Mm-hmm. I think that the appellant hangs his hat largely on this notion that identity was somehow conceded. I think we have to consider, first of all, at the time that the state filed this motion and at the response that the defendant filed in opposing the state seeking to admit this evidence. And I want to be clear, the state went to great lengths, as did the court, to admit the evidence only of these tattoos and the graffiti and how they tie to each other. There was never one mention of Aaron Warrior, never one mention of gangs. We went to great lengths to sanitize that as cleanly as possible and admit it solely for the purposes of identity. So to the extent that it's argued that there's reference to gang affiliation of the defendant for character evidence, that's absolutely incorrect and absent from the record. And I think the record shows, if anything, that everyone went to great lengths to keep that evidence from coming in. But to this notion that somehow they've conceded ID and therefore this incredibly probative evidence should have been excluded at trial, I would first note that in the opposition to the motion that we filed, there was never at that point in time a concession that the defendant committed these crimes. The oral argument, at which point in time, or when we discussed the motion before the district court before it was granted, this is all pre-trial, the defense was arguing that this is quite simply a coincidence, that the dice are showing 1, 2, and 3, and that we haven't linked them up. And that's on the record on volume 1, page 84 of the appellate appendix. And this was the information that the court had at the time that it granted its motion, when it is making this decision that it is admissible. Then we look going forward to trial itself. There was no stipulation on the record with the court between the parties that the defendant was present at each and every single one of these crime scenes, that he committed these crimes, that this is solely an issue of involuntary intoxication. That would have been something that maybe lends a little credence to this argument, because then the jury would have been instructed that a stipulation between the parties means that you were to consider that as a fact and law. So there was no stipulation. Two, let's look at the opening statement provided by counsel. In the opening statement, he does not concede that Mr. Cordiero commits each and every single one of these. He says that Mr. Cordiero, they concede ID on, quote, many of the charges, explicitly noting that he's not conceding all of the charges. And that's in the appellate appendix, page 457. It's ambiguous. The state can't know, based on that concession, that some of these or many of these cases, ID's not in dispute. Well, we don't know which counts are in dispute. And the defense has a luxury of being able to shift its strategy and tactics throughout the course of a trial and attack identity in certain locations where we can't predict. So identity is very much at issue from the jump in defense opening statement. We look at the defense's closing statement on page 1578 of the appendix. The defense counsel states that he wants to point out a few things that we, quote, do dispute as far as Mr. Cordiero's involvement in all of this. So they're still, at the conclusion of the case, disputing identity to some of these issues. He also goes on to spend, on page 1584, a paragraph citing what he claims to be a misidentification of one of the witnesses and highlighting height discrepancies between what the witness testified that the perpetrator looked like and what Mr. Cordiero's actual height was. So there's still a contention of identity at the conclusion of trial. And then finally, if we look at it, it was very much in play for the jury because they acquitted Mr. Cordiero of counts 24, 25, and 27. So if there was a concession that he was the person that did this and they rejected his involuntary defense, then there wouldn't be a reason to dispute or acquit him on these counts. That acquittal, I think, not only shows that identity was very much still in dispute and the state had to meet its burden and present the evidence in the cleanest, most sanitized way possible, but it also shows that this notion somehow that the jury makes these, and it's speculation, I think, to say that the jury can make leaps. As Justice Cherry pointed out, everyone has tattoos these days. To suggest that they can see these tattoos and how they coincide with what's left behind by this man at his various crime scenes and draw the inference that he's somehow part of a prison gang or that he has prior criminal acts or prior incarcerations is incredibly speculative. And the notion that it prejudiced the defendant, I think, is belied by the fact that he was acquitted on three separate charges. They didn't convict him of every single thing. And they also convicted him of lesser includes on some of the accounts that the state had charged. So the notion of prejudice is belied, I think, by that verdict, as is the fact that the defense conceded identity for all the reasons I listed above. I also think that it bears pointing out, as Justice Stieglitz raised the issue, and I think that the district court raised that as well, when they were arguing at trial that the evidence is not admissible. The court pointed out, well, the suggestion of this new defense that he was essentially on Ambien and sleepwalking through the trial or sleepwalking through the commission of these crimes would increase the probative nature of the fact that, well, while he's at these crime scenes, he also decides to stop, take a moment, and tag the crime scene with a symbol that means something to him, that is significant to him, and that is probative to his identity as well as whether or not he's, in fact, on Ambien and sleepwalking in what the expert for the defense testified someone under the influence of that drug would be acting. So I think that on all those grounds, the way that the state admitted it, the efforts that everyone went to even crop out all other photographs of tattoos except for the ones explicitly in contention was an appropriate way to admit this very probative evidence. If I can touch on the continuance portion briefly, I would note that, first of all, this was the sixth trial setting. This was a case that had been receiving numerous continuances. I also wish to point out that the motion to continue notes that the defense was made aware about this potential Ambien defense on July 12th, which was 3 weeks before trial, a full month before the expert ever needed to testify. And by the time the defense filed their motion on July 21st, 9 days later, if you look on page 95 of the appendix, by that date, they had already consulted with and been approved of and hired Dr. Cole as an expert. The state was not contesting his ability to testify. They weren't contesting the late filing of a notice of expert, and he was permitted to present his defense. He was permitted to testify as to, or present Mrs. May's testimony as to the fact that she was slipping Ambien to Mr. Cordiero, and Dr. Pohl testified fully on the effects of Ambien. Now, I think, Justice Stiglitz, you bring this up, and one of the kickers is if they can't demonstrate prejudice, and it is their burden at this point to demonstrate some prejudice by the denial of that continuance, then this motion, or this appellate issue is moot, and there wasn't an abuse of discretion. They can't demonstrate that prejudice. They failed to do it in the appellate brief, and when it's discussed here today, there's a reference to the fact that while they would have liked additional time to present or acquire prescription and medical records for Ms. Mays, who testified that she was slipping Ambien drug. Well, all that would show is that maybe she was receiving Ambien. Probably not, because as she testified, she acquired drugs illicitly on a number of different occasions. But even if they had that information, it would still just show that it was Ambien that she was slipping him, which is exactly what she testified to in the information the jury already received. And as to the amounts that she was receiving, that all that matters is the amount that she's actually giving him. Dr. Pohl could not testify to that. That would not aid or assist in his testimony or their defense in any way whatsoever. So I think that there's, one, no prejudice. Two, there was a significant number of continuances, and they had plenty of time to present the defense they wanted. They did. They received a jury instruction on involuntary intoxication, and the jury rejected that.
Any further questions?
Mm-mm. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your consideration.
Mr. Erickson, you have about 2 minutes, two and a half minutes.
Thank you, Your
Honor. To start with, first with the prejudice, again, going back to Dr. Pohl wanting prescriptions that he could testify to as to the amounts, as well as if we had that, that would add to the credibility of the testimony of Ms. May, that she didn't just come up with this story because she was watching late night TV, but that she had been on that drug as she testified to. The state attacked her credibility very, very thoroughly on cross-examination. And if we had had the appropriate time to consult with our expert, find out everything that he needed, and
How long does it take to get a copy of your prescription? So if Ms. May is a cooperative individual, has a prescription, how long does it take for her to go down and get a copy of her prescription to produce for you for these purposes?
Your Honor, I can tell you that attempts were made in that time frame while we were dealing with everything else, and we had an investigator who met with her and was trying to obtain those, and we were not able to do so in that time frame.
But not in that time frame. So was there, I mean, what did you tell? Did you tell the judge below, we can't get it in this time frame, we've done a subpoena, we need another week? Or is it speculative whether or not such documentary evidence was even out there?
Your Honor, at the time that we made the motion, I had just barely retained Dr. Pohl, had contacted Drew Christensen at the office of appointed counsel to get the authorization, and had simply had probably a 10-minute conversation with Dr. Pohl about the general defense issues, and that was it at that point. At that time, I was not given a list of things that he needed. So when we had the hearing on the 26th of July, I was not aware from Dr. Pohl that that was something that he would be looking. And so once he told us that, we began trying to get that. The trial started on August 1st, and we did not obtain those. The other issue relative to the tattoos, there was no disputing, and I will grant the state that when we first argued against the introduction of the tattoo evidence, that was probably, I don't know, 8 to 9 months before the trial began, and at that time we were unaware of the Ambien issue and what the focus of the defense was going to be. So I agree, at that point we were not conceding that our client had been there during the bulk of the criminal conduct that was alleged. I guess I have 10 seconds.
Go ahead. No, actually you're all out of time, but go ahead and finish your final thought.
Okay. The last issue is just simply, when both of these are added together, the inability to present the full defense and consult properly with an expert and prepare when you're, you know, 9 days away from a trial with as many witnesses as it entailed, was simply impossible for Mr. Cordero to get a full and fair trial. We'd ask that the conviction be overturned. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Erickson and Mr. Ports, for your arguments in this matter. This matter will stand submitted.